Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. And before we get into this episode, two things to mention. Firstly, I was delighted to be the after dinner speaker this year at the CPT dinner here in London at the end of January. And I made some strong remarks about what artificial intelligence might mean for our industry and also about the UK's economy. And if you weren't there, you can read it all in Passenger Transport, issue 354. Please check the latest issue if you want to see what I said to the CPT under its tremendous new president, Catherine Pullum. And I know she will have a great year as president. And secondly, I have another podcast, and it isn't anything to do with transport. I'm sharing the mic with my friend Andy Graham. Andy and I, who've known each other for years, have a real love for all sorts of trivia and remembering those things, such as those wonderful TV programmes of our childhood. If you want to know our favourite Doctor Who, go and download Andy and Leon Missing the Point from wherever you get your podcasts from. And by the way, unless you count Jones the Butcher's van in Dad's Army, I think it's a transport-free episode. So do go and have a listen. Relax for an hour on Missing the Point. And that now brings us to the latest episode of Lunch with Leon. And I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to catch up with my friend Gareth Williams. He's the General Secretary and Chief Strategic Partnership Officer of Eurostar. I thought I knew a bit about the Channel Tunnel passenger rail service, but some of what Gareth had to say was a real surprise to me. But I started out by asking him how he got the job.
I think they couldn't afford to have me in government anymore.
Well, there's a very honest answer to start with.
It was really interesting. Actually, you know, I had sort of a two-job career, if you look at it that way. You know, 20 years in Department of Transport, and now got to look back, it's about 15, 16 years at Eurostar, and so much of it focused around the Channel Tunnel. You know, my very first job was working on the regulator for the Channel Tunnel when they were building that. I joined back in 91. And my last job, amazingly, was sort of selling St Pancras Station and the high-speed link to the Channel Tunnel. And at the time, Eurostar had just been through a sort of merger control process with the European Commission. I think it said to the business increasingly how much of their fortune business success was tied up in the effective management of the regulatory environment. And I joined the business to do that. And I've sort of been here ever since doing a variety of things for the business. It's never stopped being interesting. Just when you think you might look somewhere else, it keeps being interesting, and probably none more so than today, actually.
No, I'm sure that's right, because I had the same job, except with different owners, for a whole chunk of my career as well. It's true. Just when you think, am I getting a bit stale here? Shall I look somewhere else? Something new and exciting comes along inside the business or in terms of ownership or whatever. And on that basis, I just think it's a great place to be, for sure. Yeah. It's always interesting. And I mean, let's be clear. Rail is now a really very important thing as far as the government is concerned, isn't it? And
yes. And
interestingly, of all the government's policies, the whole issue to do with ownership and bringing it back into public ownership is very important and very popular with the electorate.
Yes, absolutely. And it's that constant love for the railways that exists there in the public. And some of it may be romanticised, but I think it also speaks really strongly to the sort of the social element of the railways in bringing the country together, or in our case, bringing countries together. And it's probably one of the reasons, you know, I've stayed with the business for a while. It always helps if you're doing something you think is fundamentally worthwhile. And I genuinely think, you know, connecting peoples and countries and cultures and economies and so on, it's fundamentally a good thing to do. And I think that reflected in the passion that goes around the debate around railways, you know, whether it's sort of domestic or international.
I mean, there's no doubt. You're right about the sort of romanticism bit of it as well. People are inherently pro-railway, even if they're not major users. You know, they are inherent. They think it's a good thing. It must be a good thing to connect countries or connect cities or connect communities. It's inherently a good thing. And I suppose some of it is because, to a large extent, once the infrastructure is built, someone's going to run something on it because there's a sort of permanence. So if I'm going to set up a business or buy a house, it's likely the railway will still be there in 10 and 20 and 50 years' time. So there's a sort of permanence that the bus doesn't have because the bus can be there today and gone tomorrow. And they would say flexibility. But if it's got track, if it's got permanent way, then chances are it's going to be permanent. And I think that's a really good thing.
It sometimes makes some interesting economics for the railway itself. Take us, for example. One of the things I've done in the business, setting up the new route to Amsterdam. We're now looking to set up new routes to Germany and Switzerland. And it's not the same as Ryanair putting on a route. The scale of investment to get it going is so much larger. You're talking tens of millions for each of these routes. And this dog is not just for Christmas. Once you put it in, that permanence is expected. That permanence is
Yeah, sure.
part of the intent. So you've got to be really sure that it works, that it's going to work in the long term in order to justify that investment and justify the effort. So it can cut both ways, really.
No, for sure. Well, look, because I've used Amsterdam, and indeed I've done Rotterdam on Eurostar, both with and without changing trains during border control difficulties. But so the advantage on Amsterdam, of course, is, I mean, I live near London City Airport, so I can be in Schiphol in 45 minutes. But sadly, I can't be through passport control for another hour. The plane's back in the city by the time I've got through passports. Whereas the nice thing about Eurostar is all that border control stuff is done at one end. And as a result of that, you walk off at the far end. So for me, Amsterdam is super because we don't have all that border control stuff. Rotterdam's not quite so the same because it's a small airport and they and the customs post to meet the planes, so therefore they've got enough people. But in both cases, of course, they're a long way from the city. So
No, I think it's interesting. So actually what you get in the end is some mixing and matching.
sure.
People fly one way, get the train the other. No, though we have stepped up the frequency, because it's really been incredibly popular. And there used to be 50 flights a day, London to Amsterdam. And we came in, and it had a sort of difficult infancy, with COVID and major works Amsterdam Station. It's only really since February that it's got going in the way that we anticipated. And we thought we'd start with three trains a day in February. And as of last December, we're up to five,
Wonderful.
which was never the plan to do it that quickly. But it was genuinely, we opened this brand new terminal that sort of more than twice the capacity, and it was full within weeks. And we're now actually, within 9 months, the largest operator on a route that used to have 50 flights a day. And that's astonishing when you think, if you recall back in the day, it used to be the rule of thumb was about the 3 hour cut. There's about a 3 hour cut off between, whether you'd fly or whether you'd take the train. We're about 4 hours and 10 to Amsterdam, about 3 hours, a bit Rotterdam. And we've already got that market share, which just shows, I think, how people are turning to rail and the kind of advantages you were talking about.
No, indeed, indeed. My hard luck story, and I'm sure everybody you talk to has a hard luck story. My one, of course, is that I ignored the 4 o'clock Eurostar from Rotterdam and went to the airport because I had a ticket, just noticing it was snowing. We were only an hour late off Rotterdam in the snow, but sadly, when we got to London City, it was shut. So we went to Norwich, and I found myself at 9:30 p.m. on a Sunday evening in Norwich, whereupon we were put on a coach, and halfway down the A11, M11, the driver said he thought it was probably too dangerous to continue. So I persuaded him, sat on the step at the front, I persuaded him that if he could keep going, at least get us to Stansted, there would still be two more trains from Stansted to Liverpool Street, which we did. So that's what you don't want to do.
Even as a boy from Ipswich, I have to admit that Norwich has its charms, but maybe not at 9:30 on a Sunday night when you're not expecting to be there and you've got the A12 to navigate.
I know.
I obviously, things can go wrong on rail as much as they can on plane, but I think one of the interesting things about it, and we saw it in New Year as well, where we had issues, but Schiphol was shut for a lot of it for a huge proportion of the short-haul traffic. And rail has become part of the resilience of the network. People were transferring, they switched back and forth. It's an integrated part of the system now.
And presumably, when some people get moved off airline to rail, a little bit of it sticks because somebody won't have had an experience for a long time or might have had a poor experience in a previous generation, and they get to travel on a newer train with newer facilities and the better service and so on, and maybe it sticks.
No, and I think there's a different feel to it. In business, it's clear. If you're a city lawyer and you're taking the train over to Brussels or Amsterdam or what have you, you can pay for your ticket by the time you hit the tunnel in chargeable hours. You're there to, the working environment's there. It's not a chop change
No.
journey that's too broken up to really focus on anything, but. I think leisure as well. I don't know, it's a subtle thing, but for me, when I go on holiday, my sort of holiday starts when the plane touches down, wherever I'm going on holiday. But if I'm going by train, it starts when I get to the station.
Indeed. Now I get that. I get that. And I tell you what I was going to ask you, a couple of things I just wanted to talk through. I think I might be amongst the majority of people who find the facilities at St Pancras and Gare du Nord at the lower end
Testing.
of expectations. Is that fair?
I think that's entirely fair, and it's something we're doing something about. I said at the outset, interesting times for rail, and it certainly is. And we stood up, we saw an incredible return to rail after COVID. I think everyone was predicting, we worked off the international airline forecasts, and it was all saying it would be 18 months to get back to anything approaching normality. And we were at 80% within 8 weeks.
That's amazing.
Which caused its own issues because you've lost people and muscle memory and all those sorts of things as and you try to get the system up and running again. But it really spoke to the potential. And we merged with the Thales business at that time and said that our ambition, we thought we could increase the market by 50% by the 2030s, 20 million pre-COVID to 30 million afterwards. And that's attracted a lot of interest into rail. Into competing with us, that's a development you're seeing across Europe. But all of that means you need more capacity. There are real pinch points for capacity, and the depots is one, but the stations, and particularly St Pancras and Paris-Nord, is the other. I think they were already beyond the sort of design limits of those stations. You've had many, many baubles added to the Christmas tree in terms of increased border requirements. You've had exit checks introduced. Brexit has made a difference. You've got the European entry system coming along, electronic travel authorizations. All of this has sort of And we've got the capacity, but it's encroached more and more into that customer space. So it's clear that if we're to realize those ambitions, the stations need to be bigger. We definitely need to expand. And there are plans afoot with both London St Pancras High Speed here in the UK and Gare Connexion in Paris to do exactly that. And it's going to be an important point for competition as
No,
well.
indeed, and it's the bit I guess you feel relieved to get through because you never quite know how busy it's going to be, and you're never quite sure how long the processing is going to take, and you wonder, does everybody manage to catch their train? But we all miraculously do.
Yeah, I think that's half it. And we do get people through. We've been doing this for a long time. We're pretty good at it in testing circumstances. But the queues can look enormous. The stress levels go up. And it shouldn't be like that. It should be a walk-through experience. And it's you don't want to start your journey because once you're through and on the train, it's amazing. It's relaxing. Having
No, for
lunch.
sure. That,
All of
but...
that stuff, but you want to eliminate stress. That should be a walkthrough experience.
No. I mean, look, my benchmark is Emirates Business in Dubai, where you don't actually stop walking because everything's done by photo recognition. It knows you. You don't get your passport out of your pocket. You don't need your boarding pass. You can just walk through a series of corridors where you're being checked, and the next thing you're in the lounge.
And we should be there. Actually, for a couple of years, I don't know if you used it. We had a system in London called Smart Check. And it did exactly that. You could sort of scan your passport and register, and it would take a sort of super smart selfie that did an identity reconciliation to the same standard as a passport gate, and then you just associated your ticket with that each time, and you walked through, and it would do the our check-in and the UK exit check literally in the time it took you to walk past the podium. You know, I used to time it. I'd be at French border control, average of 40 seconds.
Wonderful.
And we need to look forward to that, because at the, you know, we had a period where, you know, you couldn't really have those long-term conversations with the UK because they were completely tied up with Brexit. You know, subsequently, you haven't really had a chance to have those conversations with Schengen authorities. They've been completely tied up with European entry and exit system. But we really do need to look beyond, say, what's Juxtapose 2.0 look like? That's a walk-through experience for passengers, you know, whether it's borders or security. And I think as we look ahead to Germany and Switzerland, what we want to do is leverage that change, leverage those opportunities to ask the authorities to think afresh about how the system should work.
No, indeed. And in fact, on the underground in London, as the next generation from the current cubic ticket gates,
yeah,
we looked as to whether we couldn't do the facial recognition on the escalators. So
yeah,
that by the time you got to the gate, it just let you out. So you did all the did the transaction on the escalator and tied to facial recognition. So in fact, the processing time at the gate was halved again because you didn't have to do the validations side of it. That's the place where we need to go to. So I'm excited for Geneva and into Germany. That when do we expect those?
2030s, early 2030s, I think. When we have the new fleet. At the moment, you know, the fleets we've got won't do the journey for various technical reasons. One of the reasons we're excited, I mean, we announced last October, I think it was, that we were buying these double-decker trains. Finally, the UK will see double-decker trains.
As opposed to the nearly double-decker ones we used to have on the southern region back in
the old BR. Yeah, no, these are not those. They're amazing. It's a $2 billion investment, up to 50 of them, but the idea is they are genuinely go anywhere trains, so we can start to operate much more of a cohesive fleet. They have the technical capability to get into Switzerland, to get to Frankfurt, and so on.
So that means they're on four voltages then, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's, you know, and it's other things as well. Now, there's a different braking system at Frankfurt and a few. All of those, you know, so the train is designed that it can go to these places, use it flexibly across the network. And that means, I mean, new routes, but it also means higher frequencies out of London as well.
Amazing. Well, I'm very much looking forward to Frankfurt and Geneva. That will be spectacular for sure. And of course, the present rolling stock is still very good for its age, isn't it? Considering how seriously you are using it. I mean, those trains are racking up some phenomenal
kilometers. Yes, because it's 600 kilometers a leg, and you know, you're doing multiple a day. You know, it's amazing how quickly the sort of million mile service comes around.
I'm sure. And the other thing I think is that the financial story of Eurostar is a sort of ups and downs one, isn't it? Slow to start back in the 90s, never quite got there, then made some great progress. Then we had all the terrible times in 2020 and so on, but great response back from that. And now really steaming away. Did I read your 400 millionth
400.
Passenger?
400 million passengers, 20 million passengers in a single year across the business. And they're really big milestones. Now, I think, as you say, it's there have been times in the past you've had the challenges. You know, you had the COVID, of course, was a huge shock to the industry. You know, we had no public support through COVID. It was all carried through shareholders.
Oh, is that right? There was no public
support. We benefited, as every business did, from the furlough scheme.
Sure.
But we did not get any COVID loans. Airlines got $7 billion in the UK in state aid, and we got zero, which meant that we had to sustain ourselves, a combination of commercial loans and shareholders.
Mm.
So the return from COVID being really strong was a real opportunity for the business to start to clear away some of that debt, clear the decks, ready for the investments it needs to make, taking us to this point where the new fleet is the biggest ever investment the business has made. and it's a vote of confidence in what we're seeing in those passenger numbers.
Indeed. Firstly, I had no idea that you were excluded from what the airlines got and so on. Also slightly explains why some of these major infrastructure projects are so difficult to get away, because governments talk about de-risking it and giving it all to the private sector. But actually, there are just some risks that governments have to take, because there are some risks the private sector can't insure against and so on.
I remember digging a slide for Andrew Adonis when he was Secretary of State once, and the slide was entitled "Above a Certain Level, All Risks Return to Government, No Matter What the Contract Says."
Indeed.
And that's true. But I think it's really interesting, international rail, don't seek it, receive no public subsidy. There are no public contracts. It's all commercial. And when we talk about this growth that we're seeing, the investment in stations, talk about St Pancras and Paris-Nord, about the depot capacity we need, all of that will be privately funded as well. But it doesn't mean there isn't a role for government.
No.
You know, in coordinating how this is going to happen efficiently with multiple operators. But if I go back to the Germany and Swiss routes, you know, we've been looking at them for a while, trying to make them work for a while. It's difficult because it's got to fit, as I say, these things take effort to get off the ground. It's got to fit in with other infrastructure priorities and so on and so forth. But then along comes government. It signs a sort of an MOU. It signs an agreement with Germany and with Switzerland, part of which is a commitment to develop these international links. You know, and within days, we can announce, yeah, we'll go for it. And now, and a week later, I'm in Cologne measuring up for curtains. And the sort of, it's amazing. No, where the land should be, you can look out and the cathedral is 50 meters away. It is just jaw-dropping. You know, I said to the marketing manager, we'll save a fortune on marketing. We just put up a poster, says, no, this is us. This is the view. Ryanair, what have you got? But the serious point is, you know, it changes the impetus. That direction from government, that voicing of support for it to happen from government, means suddenly you've got more priority in those infrastructure discussions. It's a positive conversation about how do we overcome the obstacles, not how many obstacles can we find. And it does make a difference, even if it's not all about the money.
No. But it is in the current climate that the appetite for major projects in transport is at a low ebb as far as the UK is concerned, because the government's got enough on its plate with HS2. The economic situation is not very good. It must be pretty tough at the moment to get any sort of major projects away because of the constraints that we all know about. David Leader on this very programme mentioned that the Elizabeth line cost £19.6 billion, but in September last year, the government borrowed 21, and in October, 22. So we were borrowing an Elizabeth line every month in order to balance the country's books. So that all suggests a period of pretty tough government cuts in terms of expenditure, which pushes then more towards the private sector. And the private sector is alert to all sorts of difficulties from pandemics, which, you know, we've already talked about. And if you like, other pressures, like there's plenty of money for AI at the moment, but not quite so much for digging tunnels or...
We do face some challenges here in the UK. You know, and as I say, we're looking to invest, we're looking to expand the station, we're looking to expand Temple Mills. But I think there are two challenges we face. The track access charge, you know, and track access charge, of course, the biggest single operating cost within any business. But the track access charges on the UK and in the tunnel are 9 times higher than the rest of Europe.
Is that right?
75% of our business costs on those track access charges are just to get to Calais. The rest of Europe is the other 25%, and that's been inflating at twice the rate.
That's extraordinary.
You know, and that has now, I was fine during, fine, it's never fine, but you know, during revenge travel post-COVID, okay. But if you've got that cost base inflating that quickly, that far outstrips customers' propensity to pay. I think that needs to be looked at. I think the other thing that's hit us is business rates. And, you know, if you look at this, this get a bit nerdy, but if you look at the way in which it's put together, our business rates used to be in 2016, they were about top of my head, about 20 million. We pay rates in St Pancras and at Eurotunnel, and that used to be about 20 million between those two entities. In the last valuation, that is 190 something million. And it's just the private sector concessions that have gone up like this. What that means is that St Pancras Station has now given a rateable value equivalent to the whole of the London Underground.
There are so many amazing facts that I and the public didn't know in this episode so far. That's extraordinary. So you must be able to produce a pie chart that shows where my £275 rail ticket goes, and whole chunks of it are in track access charges, whole chunks are in
No,
overheads you can't shed because you have to have a terminus, and therefore it's got a rateable
absolutely.
rate.
And that becomes materials, apart from European groups. I said the business operates, it's European networks as well, Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam, Paris, Cologne, and so on and so forth. And if you're a European board and you're trying to make decisions about where do I invest, and you've got that kind of cost base and an open-ended risk of business rates trebling every 3 years, now that starts to become a serious barrier. And I think that's part of the conversation we're engaged with Treasury now and elsewhere.
One of the drawbacks, of course, in my experience of dealing with Treasury, is that in any normal environment, you build a case for doing something. But the Treasury's evaluation model is what would happen if they didn't? If we just cut the road maintenance budget by 10%, well, what would happen? Well, there'd just be a few more potholes, but people would still get to work. And so this measurement, if you like, of how much worse would life be if we didn't put this money in, or we change the way in which we charge for it, of course, only leads you in one direction, which is, of course, is that you can cut and cut and cut. And the thing still sort of, somehow people find their way through. And I've certainly found on the work I've done on highways that building the case, that particular case for investment in highways and everything that follows through, the skills, the technology, the innovation, the opportunity, the fact that all the construction companies pay tax, all those benefits are huge. But it is difficult, isn't it, when you are
I remember
pressured
having
into it.
this debate with the National Audit Office, where they were doing a look at the Channel Tunnel rail link and the associated, Eurostar project and so on and so forth. And you get into all this science of the cost-benefit analysis, and it's going to be this, it's going to be that. And they thought, is this negative and so on. I said, well, how about we shut it for 6 months? And then we assess whether we think it's got a positive. You can lose sight of that picture. I think Treasury recognises a bit what's going on with rates at the moment. I think there is a recognition this has just got a bit out of control. A bit what was meant to be independence from governments just got a bit independent from accountability.
Yes.
So when you get a rates bill where your rates is the equivalent of 18 times the increases in employers' national insurance. And can you imagine Rachel Reeves standing up and saying, I got it wrong. Actually, NI needs the employers' NI needs to go up 18 times more. It would never happen. I think
No, it
there
would
is
never happen.
a recognition that
There
you've
would
just
be
got
insurrection for sure. No, it's shocking. But this is fascinating because most users, and indeed non-users but interested parties, firstly don't understand the whole private sector involvement as far as trains under the channel is concerned. The good and bad times, the capital employed and the cost of capital employed, and the pressures and so on the network, and the esoteric things that have been brought forward, the changes in border control, all the complications of that. The average passenger and support doesn't know any of those things at all. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if a significant proportion of people interviewed in the street wouldn't assume that Eurostar is government owned. Why would it not be? Because, it's a utility.
No, and I'm delighted by that in a way. They shouldn't need to know any of those things. It should just be an enjoyable experience that, it's part of the social fabric,
I think that's right. But of course, that does mean that people don't fully appreciate the troubles and the difficulties and when times are hard, and the reliance, as you've described, on shareholders to see it through the tough times and to be prepared to support it when investment is needed in order to grow the business.
But I think that's, in a way, it also captures the importance of it. So you said COVID times were hard and it was really tough and saw some really heartbreaking personal stories about passengers. But we still carried them, regardless of whether it was commercial to do so or not. We still ran at least one train a day. And sometimes it was just one train a day, but we ran it every single day. And in some cases, in the Netherlands, when they closed international transport, I think they might have forgotten there was a train. We were left off the list, and
Oh, wonderful.
we were the only link. And it was often really challenging circumstances under which passengers were traveling, but never had it been more important for them to do so. And that's part of the dependability, as you said, around rail,
And
passports, therefore.
there is what people call the evil private sector actually behaving with a very strong social conscience and sense of responsibility.
And we are our passengers.
Indeed. And finally, Gareth, there's a bit of competition coming down the line towards you.
Absolutely. That makes for interesting times, but I think genuinely positive times. I think people have in their head this idea of how they think an incumbent like us should or would react to competition. And it's all about putting up defensive barriers, and it's all about trying to deny its existence. And I think none of that is either true or sensible. I've said for a while, it's not competition that kills a business, it's stagnation. And of course, competition's going to come in, and some of it's going to abstract from our business, but it's also going to help push innovation. It's also going to help push market growth and, excitement around the sector. You already see that in, the plans that competitors are laying out, but also what we're doing. We completely revamped the onboard services. We've got an amazing sort of two-star Michelin chef, the world's best pastry chef, some of that, all of that on board, new uniforms and so on, but also some really sort of hard-nosed stuff like making all tickets exchangeable or refundable.
That in particular, I have to tell you, that whole refundability thing, which I think was a COVID initiative and has carried on subsequently, is super useful for people like me whose arrangements change or for one reason or another. And it's something, frankly, it's in the small print of the airlines and you never really do get your money back or the refund or whatever. So it is just a tremendous thing. So from what you're saying then, I mean, competition obviously is good for the product and good for the consumer. Maybe it just pushes government to make some clever decisions about capacity and land, depot and all that sort of stuff as well, maybe.
I think that as well. I think it's definitely impetus towards decisions like, expanding the capacity at St Pancras about what you do on depots, recognizing that, you need more capacity if you're going to service multiple fleets here in London. And, if it was us as a lone voice asking for that support, that's one thing. But I think, the government's a strong supporter of competition, and helping to enable that adds impetus to those decisions as well.
Indeed. Well, look, I know the capacity one is interesting. So I have to declare a small interest because, of course, I did buy a depot for buses in Waterdon Road, Hackney, which was subsumed by the Olympic Park. And therefore, we relocated to somewhere that we call Lee Interchange, which I think is a nuisance to you because that's where you could put some more depot capacity, isn't it?
I think everyone's looking at how you might move the furniture around. Your bus depot at the front of our depot, Greater Anglia at the back of our depot. Is there other spare capacity? But I think if you take a step back, and we're bringing Virgin into our depot. The regulator's clear about that. We're cooperating with that. But we're saying, actually, we still have ambitions to maintain our fleet here in London. We want to find that space without toppling all those dominoes when it comes to the existing transport uses. So that does require working with government and the regulator to create the opportunity to build that additional capacity. And we already employ sort of 450 people in Temple Mills, and we'd like to expand that.
And you and I have talked previously. This is all good for skills. It's all good for innovation. It's all good for employment, which in turn is good for the Treasury because all these people pay tax or VAT or whatever it is.
Yeah, they're all skilled jobs with the opportunity to come out of local training, particularly as, the demographics, the existing workforce mean they retire out and others come in. It's a fantastic
Yeah,
opportunity.
and let's face it, I think we might admit that the UK is pretty well a world leader when it comes to digital signalling. We're doing more here than many other countries are able to do or are thinking of doing. And it's an unsung story, isn't it? We don't make enough of the brilliant progress we're making in
Well,
digital
I think
signalling.
the opportunity, say we have a go anywhere fleet, which means it can be a maintain anywhere fleet. And if we can build that case for the UK, and high speed rail of late in the UK has had a pretty bumpy narrative. Everyone's looked to HS2, but here in East London, there's an opportunity for the UK to be a genuinely European-wide player when it comes to the delivery of high-speed rail expertise and maintenance and engineering. And I think we should work to seize that opportunity.
What a lovely place to end, Gareth. That is such a positive and uplifting thing. And look, I have really, really enjoyed our conversation. I mean, here am I, a transport professional, ignorant of many of the things that you've told me today. So I know that listeners will love that. So thank you so much for that. I've been talking to Gareth Williams, who is the General Secretary and Chief Strategic Partnerships Officer at Eurostar. You can find everything you need to know across, of course, at Eurostar.com. We've all been users. We've all tried the competition. We've all had great service on Eurostar in our time. But I'm sure that most of my listeners aren't as aware of some of the issues that we've been talking about. So, Gareth, thank you very much indeed for telling us that today. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Leon Daniels was having lunch with Gareth Williams, board member at Eurostar. Lunch with Leon is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. Check in with them at passengertransport.co.uk. Please leave us a review or a rating wherever you get your podcasts from, and share with your friends.